We all know Michiganians, we feel, are extraordinary for their memorable life experiences or their sacrifices, maybe for their successes, their service, or for their insights. Getting better acquainted with extraordinary people is the focus of Current State's new ongoing series, Voices of Experience. Arguably, no one shares Frank J. Kelly's perspective on Michigan, the Attorney General, or Attorney General, if you will. From 1961 to 1988, Kelly became the state's youngest and oldest AG during his tenure. For decades, Frank Kelly has been considered a groundbreaking crusader in consumer and environmental protection. Mr. Kelly started his discussion with Current State's Mark Bayshore by going back to the very beginning.
I was born just before New Year's on December 31st. My mother was told by her obstetrician that I was not going to be along for a couple more weeks. So she bought a beautiful party dress and she was going to go out with my dad on New Year's Eve. And then December 31st in the afternoon, she went to the show with my aunt. I think it was a Marion Davies movie or something. And all of a sudden, she started getting labor pains and that was the end of it. They took her from the Michigan Theater in Detroit to the hospital and I was born about 10:30 that night. I killed her New Year's Eve, but she didn't mind too much.
So Detroit, a Detroit upbringing.
Yeah, Detroit. I was born in Detroit December 31st, 1924. And that's when Detroit was, a great city, third largest city in America, the wealthiest per capita income city in the world, and more home ownership than in New York or Chicago, the percentage of people owning their own homes and so on. It was just a prosperous, and it was a beautiful town. And as a youngster growing up there, I felt fortunate, to be a Detroiter.
What were your younger years like in general? Pretty conventional for that time?
Well, what happened was my dad was prosperous in the 20s in real estate and different things. I was born in 25, and that was during the Roaring 20s. So my dad did fairly well. And what happened in 1930 came the Big Depression. And my dad lost a lot of interest in real estate and lost money. So our standard of living dropped about 50%. During the Depression, and I do remember that, but we were never rich, we were never poor, we were always somewhere in between. So yeah. I had a good middle-class upbringing in Detroit, and I went to the parochial schools in Detroit, St. Teresa's, and then I graduated from a school called Visitation, which is in the heart of Detroit at 12th and Webb. But I was lucky because they gave intelligence tests in the 7th grade, and based on that, they allowed me to skip a couple grades, which sounded like a good idea at the time. But it was a terrible idea because the kids I left behind, they had nothing to do with me. The kids you left behind, they had nothing to do with you, you're a freak. And then it made us worse. Instead of putting us in with the 9th graders, they put us in a glass room separate from the 9th graders so we couldn't be accepted by the new group. We were the glass freaks. And I just didn't like it at all. So as a result of that, I went to UAD High, which was a very strict all-boys school. I went there for a year, and I didn't fit in there properly either. And so I was pretty well lost. But the nuns who had skipped me at St. Teresa's School moved to another high school, and they called my mother and said, "We realized that we made a mistake with Frank and a few people. Have him come over to our new high school where we're at Visitation. We'll treat him like an adult, and nobody will know he's younger, and so on." So I went over to Visitation High School, and I graduated from there, and I was a salutarian in a class and leading the senior play, and I was a big man on the high school campus at that. So I lucked out. In other words, what could have been a bad situation turned out to be pretty good. And that's the story of my life. Whenever I had a bad situation, something happened to make things better, and I'm very appreciative.
You held a lot of interesting jobs as a younger guy. Tell our listeners a little bit about about that.
Well, my dad was an orphan, and so in his teens, and he had to work hard. He and his brothers had to work hard. Orphan in a sense of both their mother and father were dead, and they had to work at anything that came along. And I don't know, I must have been in my genes because I didn't have to work. My family was pretty well off, but I said to my dad, "Can I lie about my age and get in a merchant marine?" And my dad said, "Well, I'll let you lie about your age to work, but not to drink." So I got the seaman's papers from the Federal Merchant Marine, and I was sailing on a car ferries up at the Straits of Mackinac where the bridge is now.
Mm-hmm.
They used to have Michigan State car ferries, and I worked on those car ferries for 3 summers from the time I was 14 till I was 16. I was supposed to be 18, but nobody knew the difference, and I did that, and that was an interesting job. I had all kinds of jobs on those boats, you know, and I made friends, life-lasting friends that I made up there. After high school, I went to college. I imagine you go to college when you're 15 and a half. I was at college, and I didn't know how to study. I didn't know how to do anything. And by Christmas of the first year of college, I was out on the street, you know, figuring, well, this has been a failure. And then I wound up with a job in a defense plant working there. And I sat next to a fellow who had been Big Ten tennis champ at the University of Michigan. He said, I don't like this factory job. He said, I think I've got a chance to go out to Arizona and work at a dude ranch as a tennis pro. Why don't you come out there with me and you can go to Arizona State College while you're out there? And I said, okay. So my parents gave me the permission and I went out to Arizona State College. And that's when my roommate became Steve Allen, who later became the TV star of the Tonight Show and so on. He was a struggling student just like I was out there. And he was from Chicago. And we had something in common, the fact that we were Midwesterners. And his mother had been a famous piano player in vaudeville. Her name was Belle Allen, and she played for all the big acts in vaudeville. And Steve was a behind-the-stage boy raised in a stage trunk, you might say. And he came to Arizona because of an asthmatic condition. That's why he was going to school there. And I was just going to school out there because of something to do for my friend.
What was it like to watch Steve Allen's career explode after you were college roommates with him?
I was in law school when he was exploding. And he went to he got a job at WKPHO in Phoenix, Arizona, at a little station we were at. And then he got a job in L.A. after that. He went in the Army for a couple of months, but they wouldn't keep him because of his asthma. So that way he was out of that in a couple of months. So he had a job in L.A. And Groucho Marx heard him one night on the radio. And said, that kid sounds smart to me. Said, I want to interview him. So he had an interview with Groucho Marx, and Groucho Marx had him signed to CBS. And he got a contract with CBS, and they signed him up for a couple of years. He didn't do much. Then CBS let him go in New York, and NBC signed him up. And because he was an unusual guy, they put him on a Tonight Show, and he was a big hit and a big star. And, of course, I'm struggling away at law school then, but I got vicarious pleasure out of the fact that my buddy Steve Allen was a big star. He used to come to Detroit and put me up on a stage with him when he'd do his act. And I'd get up on the act and on the stage with him at the Rooster Tail in Detroit, different venues. And we got along very well. But then as he got older, he got to become very conservative. And he got so conservative that he didn't want to associate with his old, more progressive friends. And so I lost track of him.
As a young guy, why did you want to become an attorney?
My father was interested in public service with two reasons. One reason was my father had a friend who was a boxing manager. He owned in boxing in 1920s and 30s. If you had a boxer, they called him the owner. It was almost like slavery. In other words, Joe Louis had two owners. They called them owners.
Oh.
And they were just agents and managers. They owned the contracts, in other words, to the boxer,
okay.
Which means, in effect, legally, they did own them. And my dad had a friend who was manager of a prize fighter, and he was lightweight champ of the world, and they used to fight like Dempsey would fight for $100,000 gates in Madison Square Garden.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that meant that the agent got $10,000 for that fight, and I thought, oh, what a nice way to make a living. If you had a good education, you were a lawyer, and had something to offer, you could be a theatrical agent. So I wanted to go to law school to be a theatrical agent, but my dad said, oh, no, I want you to be a public service, which is kind of an Irish-American credo. Public service is the highest calling, and commerce is not. And by the time I did become a lawyer, I gave in to my father's wishes, and I said, okay, I won't become a theatrical agent. I'll become a public service lawyer. And
you adapted to public service pretty well.
Yeah, well, I was very lucky and I'm very grateful that I had a good career.
In your time as Attorney General, you focused a lot on consumer protection. How would you rate us now as a state and as a country in terms of how well we protect consumers?
You got to remember that I became Attorney General in December of 1961, just a couple of days before the new year. And nobody had ever heard of consumer protection. There was no term. There was not a term consumer protection in the American parlance. It was not heard of. And I had an attorney by the name of Maxine Virtue. She was a graduate of Yale and a brilliant woman. And she said, I should use the Office of Attorney General to help the buying public more. And she said, you should do that. I said, well, you think of ways to do it, and we'll do it. And she did. And we started starting cases after, you know, suing for consumers. And the courts allowed us to do it. And then we'd find somebody, you know, in a business where they were cheating the customers. They'd have to give the refund back. We started little by little. And it got to be so good that I set up a consumer protection division with a couple lawyers in it. And that was the first consumer protection division in the United States. And within a few years, everybody's in consumer protection. Every corporation's got a consumer protection division. They all want to protect the consumer. But when I started, nobody wanted to protect anybody. We did the same thing in environmental law. There was no such thing as environmental law as a section of the bar or anything. I had a fellow by the name of Stu Freeman who wanted to start environmental suits. And he had a theory of how we could sue polluters and get the court to make them repair the situation.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of great cases going, and I was the only attorney in Michigan that actually had court cases in pollution, the only one. There was no such thing as an environmental lawyer. And we got going on that, and we were so successful, we set up an environmental division. And then in the 60s and 70s, Michigan recovered more money and more work ordered by the courts in the area of conservation and pollution than any state in the union. And so in those two fields, consumer protection and conservation, I did quite well. And then I did a lot of lawsuits against the public utilities that were, if I thought they were charging too much in their rate increases, I would sue them. Or if I thought they were mismanaging the construction of their plants, I would sue them. And I had very successful cases on those in courts where I actually got tens of millions of dollars of refunds for people, which was unprecedented up till that time. And so I had a reputation of consumer protection, environment, and public intervention cases.
Mm-hmm.
And based on that, that's why I was allowed later. I got involved in a tobacco case where in the late 80s, we successfully sued American Tobacco. Nobody had ever succeeded. And that was the largest single successful tort case against a wrongdoer, in this case the tobacco companies, ever brought in America.
Mm-hmm.
And that resulted in billions of dollars. The settlement in Michigan alone over 25 years, over $15 billion they paid in the state of Michigan.
Which of those are you proudest of just as big topics, the environment, consumer protection, the tobacco lawsuit? Is there one that you're really most proud of?
All of these things were joint efforts. What happened, I said I had Maxine Virtue, the lawyer in the consumer protection. I loved her. She was a great, brilliant woman. I graduated from Yale Law School, all honors. Stu Freeman was a brilliant guy in the area of consumer protection, of environment. And then Hugh Anderson, a brilliant graduate of the University of Michigan, became the number one expert in America on utilities. And so each time we won in those areas, it was because I was a partner with my great favorite lawyers. And so it was kind of like a team winning rather than just an individual winning. And believe it or not, there was nobody pushing us. It was not like today where newspapers would say, that's a good thing. As a matter of fact, when I started consumer protection, there were actually hearings in the legislature saying we ought to cut out Frank Kelly's money and not give him any money in consumer protection because he's interfering with a free enterprise system, and that's communistic.
Oh, my.
And they were against me. And the same thing with the environment. What are you doing suing these corporations? They provide jobs, and you have no right to be doing that. That's not your job. And I was bucking that trend, too. And then, of course, the utilities was the same thing. What are you doing in the utilities? They're regulated by the Public Service Commission. You have no business involved in there, despite the fact that I've got tens of millions of dollars in refunds. It was years before I ever got any recognition in that area. But it was mainly pleasing in the memory of my father, because if there ever was public service, that was public service.
I guess. We're talking with former Michigan Attorney General Frank J. Kelly here on Current State. The item pricing law, which is another one of your accomplishments, was in effect for 33 years. And in 2011, it was repealed. What did it feel like to watch that rise and then fall?
Well, what happened was I was never against the idea of eventually eliminating item pricing if the retailers would be conscientious and enforcing the pricing, you know? What happened was that with the advance of the early computers, they would put out an advertisement of, like you get them today in the newspapers, a fold of sale at Kohl's, a sale at Target, a sale at, and you look at all these sale items. They managed to get those out 2 weeks in advance, but they forgot to change the computer on the cash registers at the store. So the person would come in, and instead of getting the product for $2.50, they didn't notice it, but they were actually paying $3. Okay. They were still charging them the same price. And I said, that's really a misrepresentation. And so we advocated having everything priced to clear up that situation. And I was able to get the legislature to pass it. I think California and Michigan passed it. Not too many states passed it. But that was where they had to itemize everything in the store. Oh, they hated me for that. They had to hire help. Every canned goods, everything in the store had to be. And the public loved it because you knew what you were paying for it. And that did not endear me with the retailers, to say the least. But it worked very effectively, and it kept them honest. But I said right from the beginning, if they would, you know, turn on the computers and get this price right, they can do it. And so we took surveys, and each year they got a little bit better. And to the point where when they repealed it, I was no longer Attorney General. I didn't mind it because 49 states said, we're not doing it anymore. They got it down to where the mistakes were less than 0.1%, you know, of an overcharge. Mm-hmm. Well, I said, as long as you conscientiously are enforcing it, there's no need for the law anymore. But for several years, there was a need, and we supplied an outlet, and the public liked it. And not only that, but if you caught them overcharging, like a 50 cents or a dollar, you could show your receipt. They had to pay you $5 right off the bat for the first offense, and then $10. And so that was the Kelly refund. They didn't like me very much at all. I don't think I could get a job at retailing.
When your job is fighting things like pollution or people being hurt by products, and you do that job for over 37 years, as you did, you could get a pretty dim view of humanity. What have you done over the years to keep perspective and not get dragged down by people breaking laws and doing the wrong thing?
You know, I've had a lot of time to think about that situation. You know, all through college, you think about the economic conditions of America. Every college kid did in those days. You have to have bull sessions in the dormitory about the economic system. They don't do much anymore, but they used to. And as I approach my 90s, and after sober reflection, I have to say that I believe that the free market capitalist system can work productively for the welfare of the majority of citizens if it's properly regulated in the public interest. In other words, I don't mind the idea of a free market corporation being dominant in society, which they are now, as long as they take care of their workers. My example that I turn to all the time is the Scandinavian countries. Go to any country in Scandinavia, and they have the free market capitalist system, and they do very well, and they're very, very profitable operations. Corporations are just as free there as they are here. The only difference is the workers in those countries are taken care of. There's no such thing as worrying about Obamacare in a country like that. For example, in all the Scandinavian countries, you have complete health care from the time you're born until you die. That's complete, and it only costs them a little bit to do that. No, here they, for some reason or other, the workers are bad, the teachers are bad, and that's my only beef. In other words, I'm not a revolutionary. I don't want to change the system or anything like that. I just want to make sure that we practice free market capitalism in the best sense of the word, like they do in other countries.
What about a beneficial ruling, though? Which one do you look back on and say, that was the right thing to do?
Well, I won the apportionment case. It was Baker versus Carr. That's where the Supreme Court held that every legislative body that I brought to their attention in the United States was malapportioned. We actually had state Senate districts in Michigan where one senator would represent maybe 65,000 people and 2 million trees, okay? He'd be a state senator. Another person would represent 265,000 people, and all he got was one Senate seat. And that wasn't right. It should have been apportioned on the basis of population, which is what our founding fathers wanted it to be. And you'd think that that would be obvious. Well, we had to fight it all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And finally, they did say that that was malapportionment, and every legislative body in the United States had to be reapportioned on the basis of population. That temporarily was probably my biggest single victory.
Michigan legendary Attorney General Frank J. Kelly with Current State's Mark Bayshore in the first installment of Current State's new occasional series, Voices of Experience. Listen for part two of this conversation with the Attorney General next week. If you'd like to nominate an extraordinary Michiganian for consideration, email us at currentstate@wkar.org.